We'll fix it. And a week later, we flew it out. Flew down to Unicleet and on to Nome. Well, I got stuck there for about a month. In the meantime, the airplane I was supposed to go over fixed had fixed themselves over at the Nanook, where Bob was, Bob Gleason. And so I didn't get to go on that trip. Now, I come back, I waited around Nome for about a month and I flew back with a guy named Swartman. And then Pat Reed, the airplane that he had cracked up there in behind Unicleet, why, he flew it over there and cracked it up at the site of Eielson's crash. So I had to go back, fix it. And that was quite a deal. And I got a little piece of the airplane at home. And we had, I think I spent, 8 or 9, 10 days on the Nanook. And I got acquainted with Bob Gleason, and we went over to the Stavropol, drank a little vodka. Had a good time up there. It's quite a country. And the pilot, Joe Crossan and Robbins, S.C. Robbins, myself, we went slumming while we were up there. Went out down in the village, just, you know, to see what it was like. And we all had fur clothes on, you know, parkies, mucklucks, heavy clothes. And you go into them things, and they live inside of a great big skin hut, and they got a little hut in the back where everybody sleeps or lives. And they skin right down to nothing. You go in there, and a little kid that high will bum you for cigarettes, anything that you want. And we enjoyed it there for about, maybe an hour or two, and then they had a blowout for us on the boat, on the Stavropol. And Larson, was it? Herb Larson was a mechanic. Him and I, we skied over there. I got pictures of that. And of course, we fixed the airplane and flew him up to the Nanook, and then I come out with Joe, and we had 18 bales of fur, come back to Fairbanks, come back to Teller, and then on to Nome. I stayed in Nome a while, and I flew back with Robbins in the Sturman. He flew the Sturman back, and I flew back with him. Well, that was the end of that escapade. And I got another one I could tell you. I had to get out working for Alaska Airlines, and they sent me down to Hoover Bay to work on an airplane down there, and Tony Schultz flew me to Marshall, I think that's the name, over on the Yukon. And then Tony Gomez flew me from there down to Hooper Bay. And on the way down, while we were flying along, we had a pretty good load in the Stinson. And we were flying along, and I said, "What the heck is that, Bob?" Or Tony, "Here's a great big bag floating out there, you know, balloon." And they all packed shotguns in those days, because we were supposed to shoot those things down. If we spot them in the air, you're supposed to knock them down. So this old Stinson had about 800 pounds in it, and well, that's a pretty good load. And when he started to climb, why, this thing, we could just see it disappear in the clouds. And it evidently had a sensor of some kind that dropped sandbag, and the darn thing disappeared in the clouds. We never got a chance to shoot it down. And while I was at Hooper Bay, why, the one of the guys came in there with a dog team, and he said that big thing out there in the flat. Well, one had came down, and the whole village left. They went out, gathered it in, I guess, and brought it into Hooper Bay. Now, let's see. It's getting pretty tough here thinking of what to say. We had I was going to talk about mechanics, that's right, and I wanted to just mention a few. I wrote some of the names down of the old-time mechanics that I worked with, like Bill Basham and Freddie Muller, Warren Tillman, Ron Taylor, Dick Ortman, Fritz Wien, Norman Weaver, Andy Hufford, Cecil Higgins, Art Lean, Tom Appleton, Gunner Woods, Percy Hubbard, or no, not Percy Hubbard, Ernie Hubbard, Eddie Moore, Gordon Springbitt, Orville Porter, Clyde Smith, Jink Sains, Bob Ames, and Tom Girard, and Freddie Something Rich, Gordon Mitchell, Oscar Bradley, Chauncey Coleman, Lauren Fernall, Larry Davis, on and on. Most of those guys worked in Fairbanks, and I'm not familiar with the Anchorage end of the mechanical, although I do know some of the fellows that worked down here. And most of these guys worked in Fairbanks and were all good mechanics. And I don't know, I don't know where any of my... Dick Ortman called me on the phone the other night from down in, well, I don't know, California somewhere. But the rest of them, I guess, are all scattered around. Warren Tillman, I know, is outside. But we have the best. Tom Appleton, I understand, is still alive somewhere around the country. He worked for Gillum and Frank Barr. He was Frank's mechanic, I think. And Tom and Gillum set up the first radio communication deal there in Fairbanks with Lears, T-30 Lears, and Gillum would go up on the weather deal, and when he come down, old Tom would run out and say, "Hey, you're west of Fairbanks, west of Fairbanks." So pretty quick, he'd get run back in and say, you're right over the field. And he'd come down through the clouds and finally get on the field. That's the darnest guy I ever saw. And that was the first radio communication I can remember in Fairbanks. Although we had the pilots for Alaska Airways I worked for had a foot deal that they used to send CW. They'd sit on it and bicycle the thing, and then they had a key up there, and they'd send out a message, kind of an emergency setup. And on. I've had a lot of fun in this game, lots of it. Lots of work, lots of, no money. Yeah. No money. Everybody kind of worked for peanuts in those days. I don't know, I think that's probably about all I got to say right now.
Huh? The Winnie
May. The who?
The Winnie
May. Winnie May. The
Winnie May?
Oh. Oh, well, they got on that program that I went to Flat and fixed the thing. Well, I didn't know such thing, but I fixed it in Fairbanks after they got it to Fairbanks. And Larry Davis and Lauren Schnall had flown to Flat with Joe, and they fixed the thing and flew it back. And I wasn't working for Alaska Airways, and I was working somewhere else, and they recruited all the mechanics on the field to gather around and to help this poor guy get that airplane going. So I built the landing gear, and Bill Basham and Eddie Moore and a few other guys, they fixed the prop and set it. He had a Hamilton standard prop, two position. And he bent that over in Flat, so all he had when he left Fairbanks was a ground adjustable prop. You had to set the blades. And he wanted that thing to turn up 1600 on the ground. So at 4 o'clock in the morning, we rolled it out of the hangar, took it out, and he had no starter. I think he had a hot shot in the thing, something just for navigation lights. He had no starter, no generator, no battery, big battery, no nothing. So we had to start the thing with a boot. You hung a boot on the end of the prop, and a couple of guys stretched shock cord out, and then one let go, and away we go. And we got it going, and it turned up good. And he came out, crawled in, and he just barely made it. I'll tell you, that was the closest thing I ever did see. Because Weeks Field was not very big. With the Hamilton Standard, with the ground adjustable prop, it didn't probably turn up quite as much as it should. And but he got off and he made it okay. So I got in the thing. I got to sit in the seat. And his seat, he had it all rigged, so you just kind of laid in the thing. He had pieces that come up under his leg, pieces come up under his arm. And he had a lead ball on it. He had a pulley here. And he had a string on it. And then he'd tie that string to his finger. So if he went to sleep and all, that ball woke him up, kept him awake. Pretty ingenious stuff. And he was quite a guy. Now, let's see. I don't think I got no more to say. So, must be somebody else.
We have a surprise guest here today. I'm going to ask Mr. Ray Peterson to come up and introduce him. He's another one of my uncles. I got a lot of relatives in the aviation field. Ray, could you come up here?
Thank you, Ted. It's my pleasure to introduce really an old a pioneer and a contemporary of Jim Hutchison and Bill Lavery on their Siberian sagas. This man was the radio operator on the Nanuk that was frozen in the ice off of East Cape when which precipitated the crash of Ben Eielson. And Bob Gleason here has written a book, which I highly recommend that you find and read. It's Icebound in the Siberian Arctic, and it's only a little book about 3/4 inch thick, paperback. It doesn't, the cover and all doesn't do justice to this terrific book. Bob, would you come up here and recount some of this to these fine folks? I didn't finish. Bob, after that, went to work for Pan American. He was their head of communications for many years. In 1949, he left Pan American and was a top executive, if not the top man, in Air Inc. that furnishes radio communications for all of the airlines. Bob.
Well, thank you, Ray, and I didn't expect to talk. I didn't come prepared at all. But I can perhaps tell a few things. One, I'd like to point out that when Hutch came up to the Nanuk, Herb Larson had preceded him, and this airplane that he was supposed to fix was lying on top of the snow without a landing gear, considerable other damage. Hutch had brought his welding torch and so on, and fortunately, perhaps, the aircraft was sitting on top of about 4 or 5 feet of snow, very hard packed. And they dug a hole down in there, went down, attached the repaired landing gear. Hutch welded up all the fittings on the fuselage down in this hole with the wind blowing sometimes and so on. And finally, they cleaned the engine up, got it running, dug a little ramp out of the snow, and Joe Croston went down there and taxied this airplane up out of this pit. Taxed it around a bit and said it's okay. Hutch and Larson got in and flew it 90 miles up to Nana, where I was. But this is no mean feat, and I think he deserves every praise there is for the work that he did there. He also didn't tell you about the landing he made in the mountains with Pat Reed on the way over the first time. And Pat Reed tried a little too hard, I think, and got caught in a valley, tried to land on the river in the valley, and really they were fortunate that they were not, didn't wreck the aircraft. But as it was, as he said, they knocked off 5 feet of the wingtip of a Fairchild 71. They fortunately had some dope and fabric, I believe, to repair Gilman's plane at North Cape. And these three men, Pat Reed, Bill Hughes, and Hutch, repaired that airplane, got it all set, besides living there in the airplane for about a week, and took off in this canyon and made it over to Unalakleet. Now that takes some doing, too. Now, I'll jump a little bit back. I'll forget the Nanak. If you want to read about it, read the book. It's true. I'm proud I wrote it because it's true. It's not an adventure story. So that's all I'll say about the book. Now, about the subsequently, I went back to school, and when I finished up, the Depression had come on, and as a graduate engineer, I was unable to find a decent job. So I went up to Nakeen in Salmon County and did some more radio operating. Then I got a little radio engineering job with Wamcats, a predecessor of ACS and all the rest you have up here now. They sent me to Fairbanks to take out the ARC transmitter and put in a new tube transmitter, which I did. And there I again saw Joe and Lillian and Harold Gillum, Ed Young, Robbie Robbins, some and Hutch, some other people who had been over there. So they sort of talked to me about coming back up there and doing some work. At that time, the company was owned by Alaskan Airways, parent company American Airways, now American Airlines. And they were threatening to install radio communication system. So after the Wamcats let me go because they had no funds for civilian pay, and I refused to enlist at that point, I then made a mistake and came back up to Fairbanks and started to start a little radio shop. I was going to repair radios and sell radios, broadcast receivers, and make a living until this Alaskan Airways thing came along. And fortunately, the Red Light girls had quite a bit of money and liked good radios and phonographs, so they kept me going through the winter. Then I went out and drove points for a while. I borrowed some money from Joe to carry me through. I finally got an electrical job, electrical engineering job for FE Company. I was digging holes for power poles, so that's electrical, all right. Then I came back to the States and was going to quit Alaska, but at that time Pan Am bought Alaskan Airways and Pacific International Airways and formed a company they called Pacific Alaska Airways, PAA. And they decided they were going to have radio like they had in the Caribbean and so on. They sent a man up from San Juan, Puerto Rico to take charge of this installation. He hired me as the chief radio operator. We put in the first station there in Fairbanks, which was a radio telegraph station. Pan Am, as you know, pioneered the, all around the Caribbean and South America and so on, and even later in the Pacific and Atlantic, with radio telegraph, and carried radio operators, and they carried rather rudimentary telegraph equipment. They had good operators, which was the key. Well, perhaps you don't know, but when Mrs. Lindbergh accompanied her husband and flew across the North Atlantic and back across the South Atlantic, and again when she flew up through Point Barrow and Nome to Tokyo, she was the radio operator on the airplane. And they had the same kind of equipment they carried on the bigger flying boats. As I said, very rudimentary radio gear, and you had to be able to run it. So Pan Am, when they started in Alaska, gave us the same equipment. We didn't have airplanes big enough to put operators on, so they told me to teach the pilots to be radio operators. And they were supposed to run this equipment. We'd hang it in the cabin, and they could reach up and do this and that, and then run the key. Well, some of them didn't take very kindly to this, I assure you. And some of them did. And Bob Ellis was one of the better telegraphers. Robbie Robbins was outstanding. Grossman was pretty good, and I could go down through the list. But in general, of course, they didn't like it, and the passengers liked it even less, because every time that guy would turn around and try to tune his receiver, they wondered why he was steering the airplane. Well, we started with that station, and the initial system we put in was basically a weather reporting system. Now, at that time, you did not have a good communication system. Of course, you had no satellites, and you start to go to Nome, and you'd get, in the morning, if you were lucky, you'd get a report from Ruby, Nulato, and Nome. And it's 500 miles, and you're going to stay contact all the way, because there's no radio aids of any kind. So we started in with the first station in Fairbanks, and then we put in one at Koyuk on Norton Sound to help them get through the mountains and over onto the Sound and vice versa. And Jack Stewart was the first operator I hired, and Ray Peterson knows him very well. Fine man. We put him up. We got orders to put the station in October. The best we could do for housing was a little Eskimo log cabin. We put him in that. We flew in a Kohler plant. Jerry Jones and I put it in. Jack stayed there the whole winter and ran the thing and helped get through the mountains. Well, next we started and put in a bunch more, and I'll just name some of them. We put in, besides Koyuk, we put in Nome, Nulato, Tanana. Of course, we had Fairbanks. Then we went down the other way, Lake Minchumina, McGrath, Flat, Bethel. I'm sorry, were people unable to hear me? I didn't know it. Sorry. next, we got the two Electras, which were beautiful little airplanes, and authority to start a route from Fairbanks to Whitehorse to Juneau. So we put in stations. We got that authority in October. They seem to order things up in October, and they want them running in April the next year. But so we put in stations at Tana Cross, Burwash Landing, Whitehorse, Skagway, which we took out right away, Taku Pass, and Juneau. And in the meantime, that's the winter of 34-35, Pan Am built the first airfield in Juneau. And the first airplane to land on it was one of those Lockheed Electras in about April 1935, and I was on it. But these stations did provide weather information. The one in Taku Pass was on top of a island, Canyon Island. Bob Ellis, one of the guys who helped survey and find a site for it. And I'm telling you that if you couldn't get down through Chilkoot Pass or White Pass, and you came around back via closer to Atlin, came down the Taku River, down Taku Canyon, you often opened the door into the cockpit to calm the passengers who were alarmed at being flown down this canyon with walls on both sides. Then you opened the door so they could look out and see there was a light at the end of the tunnel. And that's the way you got into Juneau. Probably that about it. I could talk a long time on a lot of things, but just like to remind you that all this was before the days of electronics as we know it today. I went on into with Pan Am, and then I was in the Air Force here in Elmendorf for 2 years during the war. I had Air Force communications, all of it, in Alaska, including the Aleutians, during those 2 years. but back to electronics. I went on with Aeronautical Radio, and that company, if you go on any airplane today, including a Russian airplane, you'll see Aeric characteristic equipment in the aircraft. It's on everything from the weather radar to the instrument landing system. the ground system, of course, has been completely provided now by the federal government. And incidentally, when we built the system in 1932, there was no federal government operating aviation in Alaska. Hugh Brewster was the first inspector. I don't think the first radio facility was built by the FAA in Alaska until 1938, and that was the range at Ruby, if I recall correctly. Today, we've got beautiful airplanes. We've got same profession, beautiful pilots flying them. But they couldn't do it if they didn't have the electronic systems to go with it. You wouldn't have the aircraft separation. You get a snowy day here at Anchorage. Nobody could get in or out of here. No more canyon creeping. And today, everything runs like clockwork, and it's due to the electronic systems. And I'm very proud to have had part in developing them. I'm very proud of the part I had in Alaska in the early days. My best friend here, and I think probably the best bush pilot that ever was Joe Carson. So, and I'd like to pay a little tribute to him and close.
Okay, we're going to break for lunch now. It'll be a two-hour break. The people that I mentioned are invited to lunch, including Bill Hannibal, the State Historic Preservation Officer. I know you came in late, and you're invited to lunch. Also, you, Al, if you can make it. We need people to come back here promptly at 2. Again, the lunch is at the Adventure Room in the Captain Cook Hotel. The people that are on per diem, don't worry about the money. The people that are not, it's $860. We have room for 45 to 50 people. And that's about it. We'll see you when you get back. Our morning session of history documentation I am real pleased with, and I appreciate all you people. Again, I'm telling you that I appreciate y'all coming and participating in this event. I think that it will have far-reaching consequences. And our lead-off speaker for the afternoon is a longtime Alaskan aviator known to everyone, formerly on the board of directors of WEAN and a very influential figure in that company. And he's acted as kind of a host, and he's helped us out a lot in putting this program on, and I'd like to thank him now for this. He's made it a lot easier for me in particular. The man's name is Ray Peterson.
High step for an old man. Thanks, Ted. I don't think I helped you very much. You've pretty much carried this load all by yourself, and I want to congratulate you on the fine job you've done. You know, it's difficult to get up here and talk to this bunch. There's too many people know me. It makes it hard to lie, and so I'll try and depend on short memories. I would like to take this time to introduce a man that I brought up here in 1939. He had given me some flying lessons back in Elmhurst, Illinois, back about 1930, when I was learning to fly. He is a well-known pilot up here, had a terrific reputation as a highly skilled pilot. Oscar Underhill, stand up and let everyone take a look at you. About 75% of the Ray Peterson Flying Service, as well as the other operators during the war, about 75% of our business was military, so we were closely involved with them. Oscar had quite an interesting experience. He was flying a Stinson A trimotor. If you're not familiar with it, it was a low-wing airplane, retractable gear, of course, trimotor, three engines. And Oscar had a USO troop aboard. He got through Merrill Pass, but he couldn't get get off at Chacachamba Lake due to heavy weather, and he went back and landed in a place that you'd swear you'd never get an airplane that size into, but he did, and no one was hurt. The one girl aboard was one of the entertainers in this troupe, had a touch of pneumonia, and the doctor wanted to keep her in Bethel. But if she missed the trip, she had lost this troop and would have to been assigned to another one. And she was enamored with a young lieutenant aboard and along on the troop, and she didn't want to split. And Oscar says, well, I'll have him in Anchorage in 3 hours. Well, anyway, 5 days later, we rescued him. But the young lieutenant and the gal, to keep her warm and healthy, stayed in the same sleeping bag, cured her pneumonia. I understand they got married later. It was all very on the up and up. So Oscar's a kind of a Cupid, as well as being a terrific pilot. I started flying, as I mentioned, at Elmhurst, Illinois in 1930. In fact, just about February 1930, I believe, we took the first lessons. I was flying with the flying club there, but in a few months, I had bought an airplane, an OX-5 Command Air. And I think it was that airplane that Oscar gave me some lessons in. In 1932, I opened the Rock County Airport between Janesville and Beloit, right in the middle of the Depression. It only took me about 2 months to go broke on that one. I could advertise on the radio and get 1,000 people to come out and see me get killed, but no one wanted to pay their money for rides. I did have a couple of students, and I was getting pretty disgusted with the whole operation. I thought, this is a silly business that I talked myself into. I'd been reading too many romance stories about aviation. So I casually mentioned to this one student that I was about ready to go back with my old boss in Chicago, where I had a winter job building vending machines, and the heck with the flying business, because it looked like nothing but a flying circuits business. He said, well, I was in Alaska last year, and he says, they use airplanes up there. Well, he was up in the Ketchikan area, and he saw characters like Bob Ellis and Sassine and Jim Dodson flying around there. And I said, what do they do? He said, oh, heck, they fly fishermen, and they fly loggers and so forth. I said, well, that's for me. So the following year, I started for Alaska, and after a hang-up at Bellingham for about 8 months, at that time, you know, Bellingham had a normal school, and I was 20 years of age when I went in there. It was a nice place for a young man, teaching all these young school teachers. So I didn't get out of there until the following year. I had a good friend, Jack Stewart, who later went to work for Bob Gleason here with PAA, Pacific Alaska Airlines. And Jack had been a neighbor of mine in Chicago, and he heard that I was coming to Alaska, and he wrote me a letter and asked if he could come along, and he said he had a cousin in Anchorage. Well, the one thing that I really wanted was someone who had a relative or knew someone in Anchorage, so I condescended to say yes, I'd be happy to have him come along. We got on the Bold Victoria along about the 3rd of March. Gosh, the fare steerage was $39, and I thought, gee, that's a lot of money. I wasn't like Wally Hickel, arrived here with $36, and Bob Reeves arrived in Valdez with 36 cents. I was quite rich. I had about $150 that I had gotten when I sold my airplane, and I'd driven a car across the country and sold that, and so I was rich. But I wasn't squandering my money. So I asked someone, I said, well, can you get up there any cheaper? They said, well, if you slip the steerage steward $20, why, he'll smuggle you aboard. So Jack and I nailed the steward and gave him each $20 and stowed us away on the old Vic. Well, that was all fine. There was only one guy aboard there that I remember, and that was Harry Bowman. Are you here, Harry? His dad had Bowman Airways for a number of years. Stand up and let everyone look at Harry Bowman. Harry Bowman was absolutely amazed at my appetite that I could eat that steerage food, but I had a good appetite then, as I have now. But I landed in Anchorage on that time in 1934. April 1st was also Easter Sunday. And I've often wondered whether the whole operation was folly or divine. It depends entirely on who's mad at me and who loves me right now here in Alaska. On arrival here, about the first place I went, of course, Jack had his friends, and I immediately seemed like I knew everyone in town, and news got around real fast. They had a rumor you could start a rumor on one end of Fourth Avenue, and it would meet you coming back from the other end, and there was a lot in that. I walked into the Star Air Service office, run by Steve Mills, Jack Waterworth, and Charlie Rutan, and hit him up for a job, and old Charlie looked at me and says, "Ray," he said, "you might just as well leave. There's no opportunity for you here in Alaska." Well, if anything would talk me into staying, that was it. I understand Charlie, for the last 40 years or so, has been down in Victoria. But I did met a fellow by the name of Les Plum that had a had Merrill's old NC-1, the old Alaska Airways, or Anchorage Airways plane, I believe it was, 193, well, it was something anyway. I only flew the darn thing. So I was a flying prospector and trapper. We were bankrolled by Harry Bowman's dad, Fred, who later started the Bowman Airways here. That was a fine operation until I cracked the airplane up at Cache Creek. So you can say Merrill brought the first that first airplane in here, and I finished it, which I'm not too proud, but it never flew after that. I went to work locally here in the nice word for it is as a plumber's helper. They always referred to it as a crapper mechanic. And I was working there to eat, and I got a call from Steve Mills or from Star, and they wanted, so they were looking for a pilot. Well, I had a hunch I knew what it was because Jack Waterworth had cracked up a Belanca up at Nalshina, and I understood that another pilot had refused to fly it. He said he had so many crack-ups he didn't want another one on his record. And I knew what the job was, and sure enough, it was to go up and rescue the Belanca. Well, I told Steve, I said, "I'll take it," but I said, "You're not kidding me on what this is." I said, "I want to know if there's a job here when this is over." He says, "Oh, yeah." I said, "From what I hear that field up at Nalshina, you may not get your airplane back." He said, "I'm willing to give up the Robin to get the Belanca back." I said, "Okay, under those circumstances, I'll go." So I got Burris Smith. He was a mechanic. Talk about mechanics, and you know I'm sure, Hutch. An Englishman, and he was a terrific mechanic. And he was riding up there with me with all the parts. Well, I landed in Nalshina, and what these miners had done, they had just knocked the tops off the nigger heads and put the tops in the hollow spots, which meant that there were just a whole bunch of miniature elephant traps in there, but the field looked smooth. But I was lucky. The Robin gear stayed on, and Smitty got out and fixed the Belanca, and I came home, came back to Anchorage. I'll never forget. I think it was the first time I was ever a hero, and it's really a good feeling. I'll never forget. The whole town turned out. I remember Denny Hewitt says, "Steve, you got a winner." I'll never forget these great accolades. And I thought that only happened to Lindbergh and Joe Crossan and Bill Lavery and guys like that. But here I got all these accolades, and it felt real good. The following February didn't feel so good, though. We had five airplanes, three Belancas, two Robins, and four pilots. And we'd had six crack-ups. Each pilot had two. But I was a hero. I hadn't had any. And I was getting pretty cocky. You know, Steve, he said he liked to pilot with guts. I flew when he wanted me to, fog or no fog. And this worked fine until I knocked the landing gear off up at Lucky Shot on the one Robin. And the following week, to the hour, I wrecked the Merrill Field Beacon out here and completely washed out the other Robin. So we each had two on our record. Only I got mine real quick. We had the best mechanics. I know you were good up in Fairbanks, Hutch. I know you were real good up there. But we had the best. We had Burt Roof and Jim and Young Bystad, Pete Bystad. We had Burris Smith and a couple other mechanics here. And those guys could make a wrecked airplane out of a new, faster than anyone I ever saw. They could take an airplane in 2 weeks and have it completely rebuilt. Of course, they were all wood and fabric and tubing. And they were expert welders. They were terrific woodworkers. Old Cease Higgins was one of them, and I know he was good, and they were all good. But we never had an old airplane. Those airplanes were always new because they were cracked up so often. I then went down to Bethel for Clarence Marsh. He had a Robin. I wanted to go fly in the interior and started the Marsh Airways down there for him in February of 35. The Marsh Airways, I had one understanding with him. I said, I keep the bills. I'd told that he was having a few financial troubles. And I said, I'll do this if I can keep the bills paid and no dividends until we get another airplane, spare airplane. By May, I had bought, or we had bought another airplane, another engine. Quite a successful operation. The only competition I had down there was Nat Brown. And if you don't know Nat Brown, he was the character. He was an old bush pilot up here for years. He had been in South America with Bob Reeve. And they didn't speak to one another very well because I think they knew too much about one another. But old Nat was the character that was going to fly nonstop to Tokyo out of Seattle, Tacoma, and he couldn't get off the ground, so they decided to aerial refuel. Another one of our old pilots who's retired in good health down in San Diego was flying the refueling plane. Well, to make a long story short, the refueling hose got tangled up in this Fokker Super Universal of Nat Brown's, and Nat joined the Caterpillar Club. And they fished him out of Elliott Bay, and that was the end of that. But quite a story with all Nat. But he was my competitor, and he was a rough competitor. Then I had another one, Oscar Winchell. He was even rougher, and they kind of cut my eye teeth a little bit. But we formed a corporation in Bethel called Bethel Airways, Johnny Litley and myself, and some of the Moravians down there. They called, so we went out and I bought a WASP-powered Travel Air A6000A. Fred Walaka's dad brought one of them up. In fact, he and Bert Roof bought two of them on floats up in 1938, 2 years later, or 3 years later. But those aircraft were, we used those in for the Bethel Airways. Johnny Litley was the other pilot, and we were equal owners of stock. I don't know who was president or chairman or anything else. I don't even know if we had one. But that lasted until 36, and then we both cracked up our airplanes simultaneously. He was in floats in Bristol Bay, taken off between a couple of boats at anchor, and the wind switched, and the boats swung together, and he hit the boats, and that was the end of his airplane. At the same time, I was delivering some pipe to a miner up in the Aralic out of Good News Bay, and I washed my airplane out. So there went the Bethel Airways. I figured, well, the heck with this, I'm going to go prospecting, which I did for a few months, and then I found I had a lot of bills, and all, I better do something about it. So I bought an Orion B-1, a derivative of the Spirit of St. Louis, and started the Ray Peterson Flying Service in 1937.